Welcome to the Best of Times podcast. My name's John Doran. Over the coming months, I'm going to be talking to people about some of the best and worst times they've been through, and hopefully find out how these experiences have made them who they are today. In this episode, I talk to the musician Kate Le Bon. Kate grew up in rural Carmarthenshire, Wales, and she sings in both Welsh and English. After an early tour with Griff Rhys of Super Furry Animals and a collaborative role in his Neon Neon project, she went on to release a series of inimitable records in her own right, staking out a sound that's as much influenced by folk and prog as it is by psych and krautrock. She neatly sidesteps the hackneyed sound of most modern indie while still making timeless pop. She wrote the tracks for her excellent new album In the Lake District while simultaneously learning how to make solid wood furniture. Reward comes out on Mexican Summer later this month. Kate, tell me about the Best of Times.
It would have been possibly 2013. And it was the first tour that I'd done with a band in the US. And it was, you know, there was barely any money in it. None of us knew what the hell was going on, really. But we were, you know, my best friend since I was 11, he came on board to tour manage, and he took his job very seriously. And then the band was myself, Hugh Evans, Robin, who's does music in the name Arseliog, and Daniel Ward, who was a New Zealander living in New York, because we couldn't afford any more flights, so we had to use someone from America. And, you know, we were all totally naive and just hurtling around the US in, you know, a Ford passenger van, and turning up to a lot of cities we, you know, never heard of, and just being absolutely overjoyed if anyone turned up to the shows, you know. And if more than 10 people turned up, we'd, you know, all celebrate. And if, yeah, it, as it went up incrementally, the celebrations got, you know, bigger and better. And we stole breakfast buffets, we all slept in, you know, one room. We all did the driving, and we all drank too much. But it was absolutely incredible. You know, we just felt, you know, the freedom of touring like that and having absolutely no expectations was just completely joyful.
So I've done a little tour like this myself. Mm-hmm. And before I did the tour, I always used to wonder, how do musicians carry on the nights when there's no one there? But my experience was you can actually get something out of those nights, can't you?
Yeah, often it can be, I don't know, often it's they're the best nights, you know. You don't feel like sometimes it's worse when there are more people there because you feel like, oh my God, they're going to start leaving. But if there's nobody there to begin with, then there's nobody to leave. So they're often, you know, the funnest gigs for the band, certainly at that point, you know, because we were just happy to be getting fed and watered and, you know, just being with each other, you know. It was
You'd already toured the States with St. Vincent, right?
I had, yeah.
So which of the cities were new to you, and which of them really kind of stood out or stand out now in your memory?
There's a place called Madison, I think, that we hadn't done on the St. Vincent tour. And I remember, I think there were maybe 5 or 6 people turned up, but it was amazing. It was a really tiny room, and it was just this really quaint American city that none of us even knew existed before we arrived. But the 5 or 6 people who were there were just a really a great audience, you know. It wasn't awkward or anything.
I think also as a music fan, there's something really, really cool when you're able to say, oh, I saw the Pixies play in front of 10 people, or I saw Kate Le Bon play in Madison in front of five people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure I could draw a bigger crowd now in Madison, but, you know.
Was it that kind of Back to the Future, David Lynch sort of America? You know, they were kind of...
Yeah, not far off, you know. Yeah, it was... I remember there was a lot of shops selling dream catchers and a really great bookshop, actually. But, yeah, it was incredible, you know, just that curiosity that you still have in your mid-20s. And
so you moved to America that year, didn't you?
Oh, God, no, it was... The year after, I think, I moved to America.
After, okay. Yeah. During my stint as a heavy metal journalist, I travelled all over America. Mm. And I've got to say that, for me, like, I didn't get on with LA at all. Mm. And I think that's maybe just because I was having to hang out in places like Sunset Strip and I didn't enjoy it. And obviously, LA is a gigantic city. What is it about the City of Angels that makes it home for you?
The people that I'd met, you know, I think it was on that tour that I played in Santa Monica and White Fence supported. And Nick, who played drums for White Fence at the time, I was so sure that I wanted him to play drums on my, you know, next record just from seeing him play that night. And then Josiah, who was playing bass for White Fence at the time, he had loved our set, and you know, he kind of makes things happen, you know. He's relentless in his kind of just come to LA and make a record, I'll help you, and that's kind of what happened and why I ended up moving there. And I guess to move to a city where, you know, that is as huge as LA and already know, you know, some people, and then, you know, you meet other people through them, it makes it a hell of a lot easier and a lot more manageable, you know. It's, I don't know, it feels like a relatively small city to me, but I guess it's more because it's more like a series of towns connected by, you know, giant, horrible freeways. But, but then, and then, of course, I mean, we didn't speak to Tim that night. We were all absolutely terrified of him. And then...
Why were you terrified of him?
Because he's got quite a scary demeanour if you don't know him. Yeah. And he was, you know, smoking backstage. And as I remember it, but I'm not sure if it happened, he kind of growled at us all. But I think that might just be, you know, time playing a cruel trick on me. But then when Hugh and I moved to Los Angeles and we... tried to meet Tim for a cup of coffee, he stood us up, which I thought was really cool. And then, you know, he became a very good friend. And then I went on to make music with him, you know.
So there's a very poetic phrase on the green card, which is an alien of extraordinary abilities.
Yeah.
And I think that goes some way to show how difficult it is, really, to move to the States. What was it particularly that swung it for you? Was it a hard process? Do you have to have like a sponsor?
You know, even just to tour, you have to have all those things in place. And so it was the first year I'd been granted a 3-year visa, which made sense to kind of then make the most of it and, you know, spend some time living outside of the UK. And I think it had been miserable in the UK for a long time, I think, that year. Like, the weather had been absolutely just vile. And, you know, when you don't have much money and the cost of living is pretty high and the weather's absolutely appalling, and then you realise that you can actually live a much cheaper life in Los Angeles and you can still work there and you actually don't need that much money because just sitting in the garden is like, you know, in the sunshine is pretty nice, or, you know, going to the mountains or whatever, then it kind of became a bit of a no-brainer with this kind of visa in hand.
Okay, Tell me about the worst of times.
Well, I mean, this is... it's never nice to kind of dig around and try and think about the worst thing that's happened to you, but it's... I think when... I mean, it was at the tail end of touring Crab Day, and we'd toured it pretty relentlessly. And we were driving to Spain, you know, on these really, really long drives, and it was really hot, and everyone had been on tour for quite a long time. And we played in Barcelona, and it was strangely, you know, it wasn't very well attended, and which is, you know, I don't expect to draw huge numbers in any city, but there was something about it being Barcelona, which is a music city. You know, some friends of mine who didn't even know the gig was on, and yeah, and just it was a really strange audience as well. I think lots of people kind of came and left during the gig, which again is not unusual, but it all just felt like something, you know, just something wasn't right. And so I did a little bit of poking on the internet to see what was, you know, what kind of promoting the promoter had done, and found a paragraph, not even a paragraph, but a sentence that said something along the lines of, if you like Dusty Springfield, this is for you. And then a picture of like a whimsical drawing of someone catching or releasing a bird, depending on your frame of mind. and I just, it just really, I just lost it, you know, and I don't lose it often. But just to be, you know, everybody to have been working really hard, and for us to be, you know, traveling long distances, and then for there to be absolutely no care taken over the, you know, promoting a show, it just makes it utterly pointless, you know. And you know, we were playing Madrid the next night, and it was the same promotion, San Sebastian the night after, and it's the first time that I've burst into tears on tour, I think, just because I think we were all so utterly tired, and we'd toured for so long, and we were playing these absolutely pointless shows. Yeah, it was. I think it was just a real low point of kind of, you know, just to say that you're on tour, or just to put tour dates on a poster, it's not enough, is it? You know, you kind of, things have to make sense, don't they? And yet there has to be an audience, or there has to be a promotion that makes sense. Otherwise, I'd rather not drive 10 hours in a really hot, stinky van.
So the whimsical figure, yeah. It was a woman wearing a cape?
It was me, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I think it may have been yeah.
When you see like a whimsical drawing of a woman wearing a cape releasing a bird, does it kind of symbolise a layer of bullshit that maybe male musicians don't have to go through?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's, you know, there's another red flag for me, which is when somebody will call me a singer-songwriter and I'll flip the mother load down the two. And especially when Tim and I were, you know, we both doing drinks, and, you know, it was completely equal venture in terms of songwriting and guitar playing, and often, so, you know, he'd be the musician and I'd be the singer-songwriter, and yeah, it's just absolutely infuriating.
Do you think people are just blind to their own privilege?
I think people are lazy, aren't they? Yeah, people just don't think. But if you're in a position where you're writing something or you're printing something, then you have a responsibility to think, don't you? And to, you know, not perpetuate any idea of inequality, you know.
Kate, How have these experiences, both good and bad, fed into who you are as an artist today?
Well, I think after that last tour, the Crab Day tour, I'd I knew I just needed some time off from music, because I also, I'm aware that being annoyed about people not coming to your gigs is also, check your privilege a little bit, and I'm totally aware, and I hated being so angered by something that is actually not that important. And I think I just become quite run down by being in a cycle of making an album, touring an album, making an album, touring an album, and doing drinks albums in between solo albums, and was pretty, I think, starting to kind of switch off from it. And when I think back to the joy of going on the road and playing music to anyone who is, will come, you kind of want to reevaluate, I think, and reprioritize. And so taking time off music, it gave me kind of the space to kind of figure out what it was I did want from making an album and from touring, and what it was I didn't want from that, and kind of just readdressing the balance a bit, it's been a really important kind of couple of years trying to figure all of that out, and I'm about to go on tour, and I just feel absolutely so excited, and I genuinely don't care if, not that I don't care, but if people come, that's fantastic. But I'm so focused on the joy of playing with really wonderful people and traveling whilst, playing music with people who, are your friends and are, you really respect, that that's kind of really where the focus is at the moment.
Whilst you were writing the album Reward, mm-hmm. I believe you were staying in the lakes.
Yeah.
Where specifically?
I was in a little village called Staveley between Kendal and Windermere.
Nice. Mm. So I'm really, really interested to hear that you were kind of dividing your time up, learning how to make furniture out of solid wood during the day and writing at night.
Yeah.
Are there any kind of interesting parallels to be drawn between the two practices, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that the process of writing and in turn recording Reward kind of mirrored making a piece of furniture, and not by design, just by, that's kind of just how it happened. And fortunately, some of the disciplines and skills that I'd learnt in furniture school, probably the main one being patience, really assisted then with kind of how the recording sessions kind of unfolded whilst making the album.
I'm sure you're relieved you didn't have to make 150 chairs to go with the albums.
Absolutely, yeah.
I was thinking, I think I'm probably overreaching here slightly, but yeah. I had this idea when I was on my way here this morning, and I was thinking about you making mugs and about you making chairs, and I was thinking, yeah, that probably mirrors songwriting, but I wondered if it was slightly a bit of misdirection when it comes to your art as how we appreciate it. You're in a free improvisational band, you collaborate with experimental filmmakers, you make music that's in a pop idiom, but it's highly experimental music for a pop idiom. Isn't, in some ways, the idea of just making a mug almost like the opposite of what you do? Like, that's craft as opposed to art, maybe?
Mugs, maybe not, because the thing that I really enjoyed about ceramics is, the imperfections, and, you can call anything a mug, really, as long as it's can hold some kind of liquid, but then when it came to furniture building, that's a completely different discipline. You know, it very quickly, a millimeter became a canyon to me just because you're being taught such precise skills, you know. And but, you know, it's kind of finding the, you know, deviation is always something that I really encourage and, you know, in musicians that I'm working with, because you can always come back, can't you? But it's always good to deviate. And I guess there are a few times when you can do that in furniture design, and a few moments when you can actually do it when you're assembling the piece. But it is something that takes, then you have to down tools and then take a day to work out this deviation that you're planning on. So it's, you know, obviously not as spontaneous. But strangely, the songs from Reward, you know, they'd been written whilst I was in the Lake District and had been just knocking around for a lot longer than songs on previous records. You know, I'd been sitting with them for well over a year before it came to recording them. And in that time, they became almost like structures, you know. They were quite hard to manoeuvre because they'd become solid in their form, you know. And so taking them to the studio was very much like, you know, deviation was pretty hard because they were stubborn, and all the things that I would naturally do, all the ways I would naturally play guitar or write a synth line, were just kind of bouncing off them, and it would just wasn't working, you know. So it just took just a lot longer, a lot more consideration, a lot more crafting of guitar lines than just, you know, bashing something out and enjoying the kind of spontaneity and the abrasiveness of it. You know, there was a lot more massaging to be done, I guess.
I guess from reading, like, I've read, like, a lot of interviews with you recently, and it seems that, maybe it's an American perspective, but it seems like, you know, the kind of strength of your accent is always mentioned in it. You know, it doesn't, you don't really strike me as having that pronounced an accent, but obviously it's something to an international audience that really stands out. And I was wondering to what extent you kind of play with this. Obviously on the new album, like, I'm guessing it's not an accident that Miami would sound like My Army to somebody who didn't know what the song was called.
Yeah. It is an accident, yeah.
Oh, is it? Oh, right.
But then Griff, when I was doing the piano shows, he kept asking about a song called My Army, and I didn't know what he was talking about. But
those may think you were being really smart.
No, I was just singing about Miami. but, you know, I find it quite amusing to me, at least, that, you know, someone from a very small village in Wales is singing about Miami. It's like but there's that absurdity, isn't there, of, you know, it's about a change happening in Miami and how it's, you know, absurd change feels anyway, you know, whenever it occurs, and just to be magnified by being in a place like Miami, you know, but nothing to do with Miami.
Was there any way in which growing up on a farm prepared you for the life of a musician?
I had a very free childhood, you know. It wasn't a working farm, it was a farmhouse, and I had a pet goat, and I spent a lot of time walking the goat with my sister, because parents would not allow TV on the weekend, and it was, you know, very much about just getting outside. But I don't know. I think I was just really lucky to have parents who encouraged music, not as a chore, but music is something that was supposed to be joyful, you know. Yeah, I think that was really fortuitous, you know.
So your dad gave you a copy of Bright in the Corners.
He sat me down and he played it to me, yeah.
that's kind of quite switched on. You know, my dad used to play me Val Dunican. You know, yeah. It's quite a difference.
I mean, he did pad it out with some other stuff, you know. There's quite a bit of Steve Earle going on. And
What else was he into? And was it kind of quite a musical household?
Yeah, I mean, it was you know, telly off, music on the weekend. Him and Mum would just, you know, listen to music. My Auntie Rita also was huge. She was a singer, you know. She'd just always be singing. And her first husband, Uncle Roger, I remember him teaching me the boogie-woogie on piano when I was quite small. And it was, it was like watching a magician play a trick, you know, do a trick, watching him just play boogie-woogie on the piano. But yeah, it was all the, that's a Neil Young and Pavement, and he was into the Black Crowes as well. As a family, I think probably we were mostly into Crowded House.
Oh, right.
I stand by today.
Right. Fair enough. I wanted to ask you about Paul McCartney.
Okay.
And I see you play Waterfalls live, is that
right?
The B-side. Check my machine. That's one of my all-time favourite songs.
It's incredible, isn't it?
So tell me a bit about McCartney. We were just talking about this before you came in. Mm-hmm. McCartney's really underrated, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I love his solo, you know, Ram 1 and 2. I think they're just absolutely phenomenal records, and I don't think he gets enough credit for how, like, batshit they are. You know, it's kind of... They're really out there, aren't they? You know? And then Check My Machine is just a different category altogether, you know.
It's like he's invented three different genres of music in one. It's this like kind of Chinese-sounding trip-hop from the 70s. It's so bizarre, isn't it?
It's really like, cheeky, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
And it's so psychedelic and funky.
And then, you know, you got this absolutely beautiful song, Waterfalls, and... But the lyrics are absolutely diabolical in a way, you know? But I love that kind of, it's that kind of absurd, writing this exquisitely beautiful song and then singing about polar bears. It's pretty psychedelic, you know?
So I've got generalised anxiety disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read in one or two interviews that you have had issues with anxiety in the past, is that right?
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, just on a practical level, how you cope with that.
I mean, I've learned to just kind of deal with it, you know, to grin and bear it. But there have been times when it's been worse than others. You know, it comes in, reveals itself differently at times, doesn't it? Sometimes it can be a classic panic attack, and sometimes it's something else, but you know it's anxiety, but it's kind of displaying itself differently for some reason. But going to make mugs was a direct kind of reaction to having like a period of, you know, about 5 days of severe panic attacks in LA. And so I went to, you know, to do something to just keep my mind off it and kind of get out of the loop of anxiety. And then running. Running is the thing that really has saved my ass so many times, you know, especially when I was on my own in the Lake District. And solitude is something that I absolutely love, but it often turns on you at times, doesn't it? And so I would just run.
When was the last time you were absolutely terrified by an animal?
An animal?
Yeah.
I stepped out of the car in Joshua Tree. We were recording Reward there, the last kind of stint, and we'd just been to get dinner. And as we were leaving to get dinner, funnily enough, Samo was talking about rattlesnakes. And I said, oh, God, don't worry. My friend has lived in Joshua Tree. He's been living here for 3 years and he's only ever seen one and it was dead. And anyway, it's the babies you've got to watch out for because, you know, they'll just bite you and they give you all the venom and then you probably die. And we were like, ha, 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 ha. And we went to get dinner and we came back and I opened the door and I swung my leg out and I was about to step on a baby rattlesnake that was just by the car. And it was incredible. It made this rattling sound. You know, everyone was talking and there's so many sounds in the desert that you're not familiar with. But there was this sound that just, I don't know if it's, you just know it means danger. And so I just stopped in my tracks and I pulled my leg in the car quite quickly, slammed the door, started shouting, snake! Ran out the car. And then obviously everyone, instead of going, oh my God, they went, where? And tried, you know, taking bloody pictures of it and whatnot. But it was kind of reassuring to know that, well, they give you fair warning. But then it went to the shed and it didn't snake to the shed. It just went in a straight line.
Oh, really?
Like, I think was the scariest thing of all.
Did it look like somebody was with a fishing rod?
Yeah, it was just moving like dead straight. Yeah, and I think I've been so terrified of seeing are they called camel spiders?
Oh my God.
Now I think I'd just die on the spot if I saw one of those.
So my son is like, I hate spiders. I can't, I can't even think about it.
No.
And then when I became a dad, I was like, you have to pretend not to be bothered by it. My mum and dad would be like, if there was a moth or a spider in the house, my mum would run up and down the stairs shrieking. And my dad would be shouting, kill it, like that. It's like, no wonder I grew up messed up. I was like, I'm not going to do this to my kid. You know what I mean? But now he's become obsessed with them. So every day he's having to show me pictures of spiders. Look, here's a camel spider. And I have to stand there going, look at that lovely 8-legged thing.
Yeah, fleshy coloured spider. Oh.
I think it looks really similar to the thing off Alien, doesn't it?
They're awful. And they follow you. Because they...
What do they want from us?
Your shade. They want your shade.
Oh, right, okay.
And your wallet. But they... Yeah, my friend Stella, she lives in the desert, and she said one night she woke up and there was one of these camel spiders that she said had been taunting her. And she said it was on her AC unit, just blowing in front of her face.
God.
And I said to her, I don't think I can come to the desert again.
We don't live in the best of all worlds, do we, Kate?
No.
You have been listening to The Best of Times with me, John Doran, brought to you by Lush and The Quietus. This podcast was produced and engineered by Andrew Payne and co-produced by Louise London. The theme music is by Oh The Guilt. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, give us a star rating, tweet about us, and tell your friends and family. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with more Best of Times.